Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services to order. It is February 11th, and any comments, or can we get right into it?
You can get right into it.
I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 440. Madam Administrator.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm just looking. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 440 comes to you from Senator Steiner Hayward, and it's appropriating, the original bill appropriates $2 million to the Oregon Health Authority for the Primary Care Services Program, establishes the Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Fund, separate from the general fund, becomes operative only if the act transferring the program to OHA becomes law. This has an emergency clause. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Great.
Thank you.
And Senator Steiner, and then who's next?
Lauren.
Tina Edlin and Scott Ekblad could come up too. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. I'm the state senator from District 17. And in my other life, I'm a family physician and immediate past president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. In that role and in other roles for the Oregon Academy, I've traveled across the state and appeared in front of this committee and its House counterpart on many occasions to discuss how to improve access to high-quality, affordable health care for all Oregonians. As you all know, many of Oregon's rural and underserved communities face a shortage of primary care providers. And this shortage will become even more significant as of January 1, 2014, when hundreds of thousands more Oregonians have health insurance. As part of Oregon's Medicaid demonstration, a.k.a. the waiver, the state agreed to address this problem by funding a loan repayment program for primary care providers who agree to work in rural and underserved communities in the state. Senate Bill 440, with the Dash 3 amendment, establishes this program within the Oregon Health Authority and appropriates funds to the program. A similar program has existed in Oregon for many years. As you will hear from Mr. Ekblad, Ms. Edlin, and others, this program was very successful in bringing much-needed primary care to rural communities, but it's been unfunded since 2009. The new program established in Senate Bill 440 will replace the existing program per requirements of the waiver while building off its institutional knowledge and demonstrated success. I will let others in the room tell you more about the significant need for this program and how it will help improve access to primary care in our state's most vulnerable communities. I do want to mention, however, that in addition to improving the health of Oregonians, I see this bill as an opportunity to improve the economies of these same communities. A study released by the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute analyzed the economic contributions of Oregon's physicians. It found that at the county level, each physician adds 8 to 40 direct jobs and 11 to 52 when indirect and induced jobs are considered. It generates $700,000 to $2.9 million to the GDP of that area annually, and generates between $60,000 and $220,000 in state and local taxes annually. As I hope we will convince you today, this program is vital to the future of healthcare in Oregon. We cannot successfully improve the way we deliver healthcare in the state if we don't have the workforce to do it. Finally, I want to make it clear that the funding for this biennium is necessary but not sufficient for addressing the healthcare workforce shortage Oregon faces. I would hope that future legislative assemblies will continue to fund this vitally important program at as high a level as possible. I appreciate your consideration and am happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Let's proceed with the panel. Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Tina Edlund. I am the Chief of Policy for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 440. The authority had a bill very similar to this one as related to the CMS waiver. I want to spend my time here today talking about the parameters that CMS put around this requirement of the waiver, the loan repayment program. So I thought I'd start with a little little bit of background reminder. I mean, we all are very familiar with the waiver, but a little bit of background on it. It was signed on July 5th, 2012. It really is the federal support and the federal agreement with us in support of coordinated care organizations, which is a real shift to prevention and primary care. As part of that, the CMS became very concerned that we focus on workforce and that we do something to increase capacity in primary care workforce in the state to the extent that we can. As part of their $1.9 billion agreement with us, the investment they make over the 5 years of the waiver, what they asked for in return in terms of a workforce commitment was that we fund at $2 million a year for this biennium, a primary care loan repayment program. For them, the important issue is it's Medicaid access to primary care in rural and underserved areas of the state. The items that are part of our commitment to the state, besides the 2% reduction in Medicaid spending trend, improving the health and health care of the state is measured through a set of specified metrics that have been established, and training of community health workers was this loan repayment piece. They, again, as I said, their emphasis, their focus is on access to primary care for Medicaid beneficiaries. The parameters they put around this program were that it would be the $2 million a year. It would be spent in rural and underserved areas of the state, and that the providers would attest that they would see Medicaid patients. If the state is unable to establish the funding levels that are required by the Medicaid waiver, there is a penalty in terms of return of some of the DSHB funds. It's actually a 25% of the difference between what they've specified in the waiver and what actually gets funded is the penalty. They actually established with us some priorities for this loan repayment program. They wanted to see it focus on certain provider types. Again, the focus is on primary care. So they have specified that they want to see us prioritize physicians, MDs, or DOs in the primary care disciplines. They outline what they consider primary care disciplines. Dentists, general or pediatric dentists, they recognize that we have a problem with dental access in underserved and rural areas of the state. Psychiatrists and mental health professionals, which is another real area of need in the state. Those were where they wanted us to prioritize. They also then allowed some flexibility.
So what about nurse practitioners?
That's what I was just getting to. Okay. Thank you, Senator. They did then allow some flexibility in their definition and say that the state has the option to expand the definition to nurse practitioners and physician assistants who are working in primary care, and expanded practice permit dental hygienists, again, a reflection of the dental access issues in the state. They asked us to prioritize to use what are called HPSA scores, health professional shortage area scores, that are assigned by, I don't know, is it HRSA that assigns the HPSA scores? The Health Resources Service Administration assigns scores to areas of the state by according to need, and it's according to geographic area or profession or population. There are different criteria that can raise your HPSA score in an area. So they don't specify how we have to use it. They just ask that we use HPSA scores as part of our criteria in awarding those loan repayment programs. Again, this won't be too difficult to do. 33 of our 36 counties are designated shortage areas in the state, so it's a broad area of the state that could really benefit from this program. The very last item that I handed out to everybody is a map. It doesn't show the areas of the state by score, but it does show what the ratio of primary care practitioners are to population. So you can see where some of the greatest need is really at a glance by looking at that. There would be other factors, obviously, that we would consider, given that there are other factors considered as part of the scoring mechanism. I, too, my final statement is that I would reiterate what the senator said about this program not solving the problem in 2 years. We see the aging of the physician workforce. We see a decline. I think other people coming after me will talk about the decline in numbers of primary care providers in the state that we've experienced over the last few years. There's going to be an increasing need as we see more insured people in the state with 2014 coming up very, very fast. So this program is really critical. I think it's going to be critical for beyond this biennium. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Tina.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, which is located at Oregon Health and Science University. And I am also here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 440 and the -3 amendments. For anyone who's not familiar with the State Office of Rural Health, there is one in every state, and the mission of our Office of Rural Health is to improve the quality, availability, and accessibility of health care for rural Oregonians. Many of the state offices of rural health, like the one in Oregon, also administer programs to benefit urban underserved areas as well. You know, one of the reasons that this loan repayment program is so important is, at the risk of stating the obvious, providing health care to publicly insured and uninsured populations is not exactly a profitable endeavor. And so it's difficult to ensure that there are enough providers to care for folks who are on Medicaid, Medicare, or self-pay. Oftentimes, providers with the really staggering amounts of student debt that they come out of their training with really see no other choice than to go to where there's a more profitable practice, at least until they pay their student loans off, which, of course, can be a minimum of 10 years. So Senate Bill 440 creates a loan repayment program to incentivize these providers to see Oregon Health Plan members in rural and other underserved parts of the state. It replaces but builds upon the existing primary care services loan repayment program, which is currently administered by the Office of Rural Health. It was formerly known as the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program. It's been around since 1993 and has been mentioned already. Funding for that program was discontinued in 2009. So there were awards through that program from 1993 through 2008. A total of 79 healthcare professionals received loan repayment during that time period. And at the end of this calendar year, all of the loan repayment recipients will have completed their service obligations. So the last payments will be made by the end of the calendar year. There is, and hopefully you got a copy of my testimony, there is a chart in there that shows the breakdown of the professions that have received loan repayment awards during this period of time, all the way from 42 physicians down to 2 pharmacists and 2 dentists. One of the reasons they are so low is because they were added to the program as eligible professions fairly late in the game. And then the last page of this testimony is a map showing where the awardees practice to meet their service obligation. And as you can see, it's a very good distribution all over the rural parts of the state. The criteria while this program had funding was that all loan repayment awards go to people practicing in rural parts of the state. The map also shows the number of people in each community that have that are there receiving loan repayment. The primary care or rural health services loan repayment program has a very impressive track record of retention amongst its recipients. Of the 79 providers awarded, we know of 41 who are still practicing in rural Oregon. There could very well be more, and I assume that there are. But after their service obligation is done, it's very hard to continue tracking them. We know that at least 41 of those 79 are still receiving the rural health care provider state income tax credit. That's one way to track them, but there are many who are in rural communities that, because they're on the staff of a rural hospital, aren't eligible for the tax credit. So there's probably more than 41. Senate Bill 440 allows the Oregon Health Authority to contract for the administration of this program or parts of this program, and I just wanted to say that the Office of Rural Health would be more than happy to do what we can. We are happy to bring our expertise and other loan repayment programs to bear on this one. In addition to the primary care services loan repayment program, we also administer what's called the Oregon Partnership Loan Repayment Program. That is funded 50% by a federal grant, 50% matching funds from the community where the loan repay awardees go to practice. And the loan forgiveness program, which was just created during the last legislative session. So we do have a bit of experience in running these sorts of programs. And with that, I am going to say thank you for the opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
I just have one. The amount of loan repayment, will that be the same for each profession, or how will you determine the amount that will go to, say, a dental hygienist versus a nurse practitioner versus a physician?
I don't think that's been completely determined, but what we've talked about is the loans being in proportion to the debt incurred.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm very pleased to be a co-sponsor of this legislation. I'm excited to get it down to Ways and Means. But as we wrestle with access to primary care, I just want to be sure the committee is aware that just because you might have a number of primary care physicians in an area in a pretty decent proportion doesn't mean that the Medicaid population has access to those providers. And I just want to underline that while people might not think about this, but in Multnomah County, certainly in my part of Multnomah County, we have a real problem with access to primary care. If you tried to get into the Multnomah County Health Clinic as an uninsured patient, you're looking at calling every morning at 8 o'clock in the morning for a good 3 weeks before you could get in. And some of the surrounding areas that might be considered rural actually have a higher proportion of primary care providers than Multnomah County does. I'm not saying that in any way to undermine the bill. I absolutely support it, but as we're going through, I just want to make sure that when we look at what's underserved, we shouldn't assume that everybody in Multnomah County has great access to primary care. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Shields, you do make a good point, because many providers do not want to serve the Medicaid population. They just don't. Yes, do you want to read?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I can share the experience. The Office of Rural Health also administers the Rural Provider Malpractice Subsidy Program. And one of the ways that we make sure that incents people to see Medicare and Medicaid patients is that we require part of the application process is for them to attest that they will keep their practice open to the same percentage of Medicaid and Medicare patients as exists in their county. And I assume that something similar to that would be a requirement of receiving a loan repayment award.
May I just expand on that, Madam Chair? Thank you, and Senator Shields. You know, one of the conversations that I've already had with Mr. Ekblad and with Ms. Isrick from the Healthcare Workforce Institute and with Ms. Edlin is, how are we really going to define underserved? And Ms. Edlin mentioned that CMS has asked us to use the HPSA scores as one strong criterion. And although Multnomah County isn't officially designated, doesn't have any officially designated HPSA areas, there's no reason that as we continue to look at this carefully, we shouldn't take into consideration access for certain populations, especially Medicaid populations, wait times for appointments, things like that. So your bringing this up is very helpful as we start to think about what's going to go into the rulemaking and how we define underserved.
Can I follow? Also, maybe this is for Tina. Do we have any indication, any study versus how rural providers are reimbursed versus how urban providers are reimbursed? I mean, there's this notion that you get paid more if you live in Multnomah County, but do we have any evidence to back that up?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I don't have any information. I can look, though, see if there is any work that's been done.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, I'm assuming everybody's on board with the threes at this point, correct?
I couldn't hear the question. I'm sorry.
The dash three amendments.
To the best of my knowledge, there's only one small concern from one. I think you'll be hearing from our colleagues, the naturopathic physicians, who are concerned that they aren't on that list that Ms. Edlund outlined for us. And I appreciate their concern. And would just say that we worked very hard to get nurse practitioners and PAs and dentists included, and that was as far as CMS would budge on this, past physicians. So we saw the need to include a much broader range of providers than just those of us with MDs and DOs after our name. So I completely respect and I look forward to hearing their testimony about this. But to the best of my knowledge, that's the only concern with the Dash 3s at this point, sir.
And we're on cutting edge regarding, quality, I think, naturopathic physicians. So it's going to take CMS a while, I think, to get their act together.
Madam Chair, I'd just say I like the 3s a lot better because it's, rather than 2, it's 4. million, and but I would also suggest that doesn't spread that far to begin with. So
we actually have numbers, Senator, Madam Chair, if I may, and thanks to Mr. Ekblad, we know that looking at the history of the awards given, for example, over the extent of the program since 1993 that Mr. Ekblad described, the average award, total award for physicians, MD or DO, was $61,000 in total, with the largest being about $100,000 over 5 years. For nurse practitioners, the average was about $25,000, with the largest award $75,000 over 4 years. And they kind of vary for that. So using those kinds of numbers, if we use $2 million of it for physicians, dentists, and pharmacists, that could get us about 32 of those, and $2 million for nurse practitioners, PAs, and extended practice dental hygienists, and psychologists and social workers who tend to have lower debt load, that could get us 64 of those. So we're talking about 96 providers. Yeah. It does not go very far, and that's why we all keep making the point that this funding is a good start, but will be nowhere near sufficient to begin to address our healthcare workforce shortages. And assuming that we are able to move this bill forward, which I think we all really hope we will quickly, I hope that it will be clear that legislative intent is that this will not only be funded for this biennium, but will be funded as generously as possible for future biennia.
I would support that, too. So,
thank you, Senator.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Lisa Dodson and Melissa Jeffers and Sarah Williams. Please proceed.
I'll set my testimony over there for the assistant when she returns to her desk. Senator Mona Sanders-Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Dodson, and I'm a family physician at OHSU as well, and the director of the Oregon Area Health Education Center's program there. But I'm here primarily in several other capacities today, representing the Oregon Academy of Family Physician, for which I'm a board member and the secretary, the Oregon Rural Health Association, for which I'm a board member. I'm also currently the chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board's Healthcare Workforce Committee, and also the Oregon Medical Association's Workforce and Access Committee. So I'm representing each of those organizations as well today. I will not dwell on points that have already been eloquently made by my predecessors here, but would like to make a few other points with your indulgence. As has been mentioned, the two-year loan repayment time will not begin to cover all of our problems. There are other methods as well. In the 2011 session, we had a loan forgiveness program of $500,000. That was targeted to reducing the debt of students prior to their incurring the debt, so in other words, while they're in school. And that we have a student here who is a recipient of that award and will speak more eloquently than I. There are also scholarships and other methods of reducing indebtedness of students. The loan repayment program typically recruits providers as they are ready to enter practice, and so therefore the turnaround is very quick, and that is helpful. But it attracts many people who do not have any tie to Oregon, who may come here strictly for the loan repayment, and does nothing to guarantee that we will be able to retain those providers after the term of their obligated service. A loan forgiveness program, on the other hand, reduces the upfront debt load of our students, thereby facilitating practice and specialty choices more toward the less economically favorable careers that they might choose. It also benefits current Oregon students, builds the the grow your own pipeline and increases the opportunity for diverse Oregon students from both ethnic, geographic, and financial diversity. Scholarships have a similar characteristic and are specifically often used to target students who would not otherwise attend OHSU because of receiving better financial incentives to attend their training elsewhere, specifically for physicians. We have a significant workforce problem already. The Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute is about ready to release a report that shows we lost more than 300 primary care providers in the last biennia during that two-year period of time in that licensure cycle. That is on top of a rapidly growing number of baby boomer healthcare workers who are queuing up to retire in droves over the next 5 to 10 years, further exacerbating the problem. The primary care loan forgiveness program, as I mentioned, will also help, but also only has provided scholarships for 5 or 6 students a year. So again, a fairly small number. My main message today is that we need a comprehensive approach, that we cannot rely on this program alone, although this is a vital centerpiece to an overall policy and a sustainable approach to our workforce recruitment and retention needs for the next decade while we anticipate a rather large increase in our patient populations. And I'll be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More a comment than anything else. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated what you said about us losing 300 providers, because it goes back to a conversation that Dr. Steiner Hayward and I had before, which is, you know, I think we're also losing a lot of people who have a lot of experience, and the more experienced the practitioner, the greater their ability to keep down costs. That seemed to be highly associated with, you know, the skill and the experience of the practitioner. And so while it's important to bring people in, it's also important to stop the hemorrhaging of people leaving or just deciding they can't make a living in primary care once they put out their own shingle. So
correct.
Just wanted to make sure that we're somehow thinking about that as well. How do we make sure that primary care providers are compensated well enough to continue that even when they might get a loan repayment?
Thank you. And I did not come prepared today to discuss that part of the retention aspect, but there is significant data and programs that we could certainly discuss at another time if you would like more information on what's being done. And, one last thing. On the last two pages of the handout is a, unfortunately not completely currently up to date, but list of loan forgiveness, scholarship, and repayment programs from around the country. And essentially, those are our competitors, if you will, for that workforce. If we do not offer them loan repayment and scholarships, other folks are queuing up to do so.
Thank you. Dr. Dodson, can I just clarify one thing you said? I really appreciate your comments about clarifying about the differences and advantages and disadvantages of loan forgiveness programs and loan repayment programs, because those two terms can be hard to tease apart, and you did a very good job of it. But to get at your point about the concern about whether providers who come in from out of state for our loan repayment program will stay, I wonder, Mr. Ekblad, if you could just comment, or maybe Dr. Dodson, you know the answer to this. Of the 41 that you know for sure are still getting the tax credit, do we have any way of knowing, or of the 79 who've been part of the program, how many of them came in from out of state? Or do we know that number now, or could you get it for us? Because I just want to, I have some colleagues, I will be clear, who think loan repayment programs don't work. And I think that we know that it depends on how long you stay in the community and, you know, initially how long the program's for, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I'd like a little clarity around that, please.
Sure. You know,
state your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. And while I don't have that information with me, we could certainly find it out. However, the award decision-making process was set up such that folks who had recently moved to the state to practice, so in other words, they came for reasons other than loan repayment, or had gone through an Oregon school or had a tie to Oregon, received priority in the decision-making process. And that was quite intentional, because we know that those ties generally lead to better retention. I can also bring data that shows the number of years of service that have been provided to our patient populations simply because of the physicians who are still around.
Thank you very much. And so when the Dash 3 amendments make it clear that most of the plans for this program will be set up by rule, and you'll be able to bring all those that experience to the table as we do the rulemaking for this when we move forward. And if I could just ask one other question really quickly about the rulemaking process. My understanding from speaking with you separately is that we need to be moving as rapidly as the legislature feels it can, because if we're going to get all this, finally identify the relevant communities and attract the relevant providers and get all this money allocated in the next biennium, we really would be best served to have the rulemaking done by the beginning of the next biennium, which would mean that we would need to pass this actually out of the legislature, including the appropriation, in a pretty timely fashion. Is that a correct understanding, or am I overstating the case?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I don't think you're overstating the case at all. In order to do this, I think with the intent of a good match and retention, just setting up that process and making sure it's a very thorough process does take time, and the sooner the better.
Thank you very much.
All right. Senator Imani Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Williams, and I'm a fourth-year medical student. I'm also a rural scholar and a recipient of the Loan Forgiveness Program, Oregon Primary Care Loan Forgiveness Program, and I have a short story to tell you. So I am coming into family medicine because I feel like it's a calling towards primary care service, and having exposure abroad and in Oregon, I feel like primary care is essential to increasing the well-being and health of the population in Oregon. And on a grand scale, I feel like family medicine is a specialty you can go into that has a lot of potential for impact. And we're coming into a time where it's very prudent to start beefing up primary care and including family medicine. I think there's a really real chance to improve the health and lives of Oregonians and abroad. So I think among medical students also they view primary care specialties as a calling to service, and I think that's because it's a difficult area to serve in, and also I think it's considered that because you can make twice as much in other specialties, and so that doesn't deter me from doing what I want to do, but I think that's kind of the attitude of some of the medical students, that it's a calling to service to go into a primary care specialty, and so I feel like you had those medical students that are okay with having less financial gain in the end, or more comfortable with financial gain in the future, or willing to go into it. So I think this program is necessary, because even though I did receive the loan forgiveness program, which I'm completely grateful for, it was $30,000 for 1 year, and I'll be coming back to Oregon after residency to for that year of service, which of course I plan to continue for my career. But I went through medical school completely on loans, and it'll amount to almost $250,000, so $245,000+. And my husband is also a medical student, so our debt load is double. And just doing the math, we'll pay that off over 25 years at 8% interest. That'll be roughly $4,000 a month, and be about $1 million in the end that we'll pay off to go to medical school. So it's a substantial burden, and something that we'll have to come at from multiple angles. And this program would be absolutely critical to helping us in our endeavor to be in a rural Oregon community and contribute to primary care service in our state. I thank you for your time. Thank you very much for coming.
Senator Moniz Anderson and committee members, my name is Melissa Jeffers. I am a third-year resident, the chief resident at Providence Milwaukee Family Medicine Residency, which is just outside Portland. To give you a little context of who I am a homegrown physician. I grew up in Canby, went to U of O, went to OHSU, and now I'm in Milwaukee and planning to stay in Oregon for as long as I possibly can. And I chose family medicine for a lot of the same reasons. I saw it as a calling, and I was really inspired by a family physician before I even attended medical school. He did a solo practice, mom-and-pop operation, had been in practice for 30 years, and I was so touched by how he was able to take care of people as individuals, but as members of their families, as members of their communities, and provide this longitudinal, holistic care, focusing on behavioral changes and preventive medicine that really spoke to me about how I feel like healthcare can be delivered to people in Oregon. That doctor graduated from medical school with less than $10,000 in debt and immediately went into practice. By contrast, my medical school loans all by themselves right now are $196,000. I similarly have a husband who has educational debt, so we also feel that same red. We're always in the red. We have that burden as well. So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to talk about numbers a little bit with that in mind. When I was a fourth-year med student, we surveyed my graduating class and assessed our debt load. I actually am pretty average for the middle of the road. Debt ranged anywhere from $18,000 up to $450,000 just for medical school. And we asked those students how much effect their financial debt played into their specialty choice, and only 6% of my graduating class said that it didn't matter. The higher the debt went, the more they thought it mattered, and the more they were prone to choose specialty care, because you can make twice or more in those fields what you do in primary care. We also asked the question, if you were offered loan incentives, such as repayment or forgiveness, would that prompt you to choose a primary care profession, which we chose as family medicine, internal medicine, obstetrics, and pediatrics, and 60% of my class said that they would. So that tells you a little bit about how much money weighs on our minds, even though it is a calling and something we choose to do as a life of service. Right now in my training, I'm at the point where I'm looking for jobs. I've got an interview tomorrow. To speak for my peers who are in that position, we don't feel like we can choose rural practice because the financial incentives to stay in the urban centers are so much more compelling. If I were to go and work in Madras, for example, there would be no salary guarantee, and I would probably make $50,000 a year less than I could make staying in Portland. Even if I wanted to stay in the urban center and work at a federally qualified health center such as Virginia Garcia, I would make $40,000 a year less. So that, when you're faced with $200,000 plus of student loan debt, makes a really big difference when I still want to buy a house and raise children and have other expenses in my future. And when Gary Plant, the president of the OAFP, spoke with my graduating class at our residency 201, we all said that we don't feel like we can afford to go into rural practice because of our debt load. So programs like this that help offset the cost of that financial burden are huge. They make a big difference to us when we're choosing our specialties, and then again when we're looking for where we can be employed within the state. And I would encourage you to fund this as much as you can and to make it consistent over several years. Removing the financial barriers to primary care and to distributing primary care across the state are pretty important to providing good health care for all of Oregonians. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to testify. Questions?
Yes, Senator Shields.
I was really interested in what you said about working in Madras. Was that because you'd have to put out your own shingle as a provider and you wouldn't have a hospital that you can go work at under salary? Is that what you meant?
That's part of it. The financial security of being able to have a salary guarantee is really hard to look past. And when you leave the Portland area or maybe Salem, Vancouver, you lose that safety net of knowing that I will make enough to pay down my loans in any given year. Also, people my understanding is that folks in rural practice generally make less. They don't get to participate in these huge hospital systems that can evenly make a salary offer to new applicants. So it's both the guarantee, but it's also actual reimbursement.
Thank you.
Oh, okay, thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call Jennifer Barr, Laura Mojeski, and Phil Donovan. Please proceed.
I'll go first. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Barr, and I am a third-year DNP student at the University of Portland. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon.
DNP?
DNP stands for Doctorate of Nursing Practice.
Okay.
It's one of the newer programs that have kind of come up. They're moving from master's prepared programs to doctorally prepared programs. So it's a four-year program. I'm in my third year. And I'm looking at, our program is a family nurse practitioner program, so every one of my classmates will be specializing in family health care. We're looking at receiving education about how to care for babies, how to care for the elderly, moms, everyone that you think of when you think of family health care. And it also means primary care, and that's what all of us are really excited about in looking at primary care programs. Our university has a specific tract called Caring for the Poor, which is a focus where you can elect to be on this track, and I've elected to be on it. And it just means that we have extra education about how to care for those that live in our underserved population or a rural population. We look at how to reduce health disparities among them. All of my clinical rotations are in areas that are underserved or working with those in rural areas. So, I just wanted to kind of share some personal information with you guys. I've been working full-time as I've going through this program, trying to pay for it and as occur at the least amount of student debt as possible, but I'm still looking at around $100,000 when I graduate next year. And it just makes me sad because I'm not sure that I can afford it to go into primary care and do the things that I'm learning and care for these patients the way that we're being taught to. And still be able to pay for my student loans. So I'd just like to thank you in supporting Senate Bill 440 and would welcome any questions that you might have.
Good afternoon. Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Laura Mojeski, and I'm here on behalf of the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific Northwest, Comp Northwest. We are established in 2011, and our campus is located in Lebanon. We are currently on our second year of students, and I just wanted to say thank you very much for bringing Senate Bill 440 to the table. We are in 100% support of the intent of the bill. We just wanted to make sure that this applies to both medical schools who are training primary care physicians in Oregon. We are currently working with staff, Alana specifically, to move this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
If I could, just to be clear, we absolutely include osteopathic physicians, and we make no distinction between MDs and DOs in the context of this legislation. There's every intention, and that's been true for the loan repayment program that's been in existence for 20 years now. That has never been an issue for us, and it would be every intention. And we know that osteopathic physicians have a great track record of choosing primary care. So we have every reason to want to include DOs in this.
Great. Thank you.
And then there's NDs. For the record, Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. You know, naturopathic physicians are trained as primary care providers. They go to get a 4 and sometimes 5-year doctoral degree. They incur the same amount of debt that the other schools create for students. And I want to say, I've seen the interest level of naturopathic physicians in being in rural and medically underserved communities. A couple years ago, I was asked to come make a presentation at the College of Natural Medicine, and I came into the lecture hall, and there were students in every desk. There were students sitting on the floor, eating their lunch, and I realized there must be something else on the agenda than me that attracted such a large crowd. And the answer was a naturopathic physician from the state of Washington who practiced in a rural setting. And she was there to share with these students what it took to set up a practice, and frankly, was full of a lot of encouragement for the welcome that they would get if they were to do so. Interestingly, the state of Washington has a very successful loan repayment program. That loan repayment program has served naturopathic physicians very well. And in 2010, this legislative body had the wisdom to include naturopathic physicians in the statutory program that Scott runs. Now, of course, I sit before you concerned that Dash 3 amendment eliminates provider types from that list and turns that over to the OHA to determine by rule. Now, our recent experience has been that the Oregon Health Authority is doing their best to use all providers to the maximum extent of their training. We've seen that. You know, naturopathic physicians have been able to see a small portion of the Medicaid population for years and years. And under the transformation, we're seeing the state of Oregon expand that population of Medicaid patients that are eligible to see naturopathic physicians. And for that, we're very happy. And we would want to say today to you that our expectation is that they will continue to recognize the role and the benefits that naturopathic physicians can play in meeting the primary care needs of this state. Now, my ask then of this legislative committee is that you would make clear that you expect the Oregon Health Authority to use eligibility criteria for all primary care provider types going forward and into the future. So with that, I thank you for your time.
It would be interesting to know who is driving the exclusion of naturopathic physicians. I heard, I think, Tina, but I don't see her here, that it is the CMS. I do know there is one CCO that doesn't want to include naturopathic physicians. I don't know if they've gone through the advisory committee or not. But I think because we're so new in including naturopathic physicians as primary care providers, I'd like to have some input on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been very closely involved with this for the past 7 months, working on this with many people. And I want to be very clear to the naturopathic physicians, as I mentioned in my earlier testimony, there is enormous amounts of respect for the value that naturopathic physicians bring to healthcare in this state. And I include me in that group. And as Ms. Edlin mentioned, the list of providers that we got from CMS was what we got, and that was actually took a push on our part to get it past the MD and DO community to anybody else. One of the reasons that we chose to do this through rule is because it would give us the opportunity to revamp in 2 years without having to take it through a statutory change, because we are only bound by the requirements of the waiver and CMS's direction for this biennium with regard to loan repayment. And so it had been my hope and expectation, and I think that's true of everybody who's been involved in this conversation, that come 2015, when we're thinking about how we're going to fund this program and redoing the rules for how we're going to administer this program in the 15-17 biennium, that we would absolutely be able to expand it back out at that point. Whether we could include naturopathic physicians on the list, but just at a lower level since CMS didn't include them on their priority list or not, I don't know, and I would be happy to clarify that with Ms. Edlund. But please rest assured that this was not, there was every intention to be inclusive rather than exclusive, and that we were specific about doing this by rule rather than by statute because it gave us more flexibility to change it easily when our circumstances change and the requirements placed on us by the waiver change as the waiver goes along. Does that help, Senator Mona Sanderson?
Absolutely.
And Mr. Donovan?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, you know, it's with a bit of bitter irony that we got into the program when there was no funding, And now that there is no funding, or now that there will be funding, the list gets changed. Appreciate your comments for the record about, you know, how you're approaching this, how you view it for the future. We want to be partners with that. When we worked to make the inclusion of naturopathic physicians in 2010, we said we would want to be a part of a coalition of providers to press for ongoing funding. That commitment remains the same, and I appreciate you, Chair Monis Anderson, for allowing me to sit up here with the NPs and DOs. Thank you.
You bet. Okay. And I thank you, panel. And I have another just comment to make. I don't have a problem with people coming from outside the state coming to Oregon, because usually when they come to Oregon, they stay. I know so many of our educated people go to other states. So I'm not too worried about excellent providers coming to this state, because we need them. And if that can incent them to stay here, then I'm all in favor of that.
You stay.
I came here for residency, expecting to stay for 3 years, and that was 23 years ago. So I don't think I'm going anywhere anytime fast.
All right. Any other comments? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Senator Shields.
To Phil. So it looks like that the Oregon Health Authority asked for some flexibility for other provider groups. Did they ask for that flexibility for yours, and it was rejected from CMS? Is that what I'm hearing, or do you know if they even asked?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, my understanding is that the full suite of providers was put forward. It was with some interim consultation, particularly by Senator Steiner Hayward, that was put forward, that naturopaths be included. I guess the only aspect that kind of leaves me scratching my head is that, you know, there's definitely federal prohibitions of naturopathic physicians working with Medicare patients, but we're able to see Medicaid patients. And we want to be able to see Medicaid patients.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, anything that this committee can do moving forward on this topic, I think we're interested in figuring out a solution, whether it's working with our federal delegations or somehow working to make this switch. Because if you want, to really dive in with more veracity into the lucrative world of Medicaid, jump on in. The water's fine.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And again, I think Dr. Steiner Hayward did say, or at least one of you said, that we're under this waiver for 2 years. 2 years. And then that's why it's nice to do it by rule. All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 440 and open a work session on Senate Bill 440.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to Senate Bill 440.
Senator Cruz moves the -3 amendments into Senate Bill 440. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 440 as amended by the -3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 440 as amended with the -3s to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means
with
a
due pass recommendation.
You didn't let me finish. With a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries.
Now, before you close on this, I would also recommend that when it does get to the floor, that Senator Steiner Hayward should carry it.
It's her bill, yes.
Well, she's on the sub, too,
yeah,
but still.
Okay, with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 440. And colleagues, I didn't expect to spend this much time on that bill. I didn't think it was that complicated. But we have three more bills, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 101. Sandy, can you bring us up to date?
Senate Bill 101, Madam Chair, comes to the committee at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. It's eliminating from the Impaired Health Professional Program the requirement that employers of the programs participants establish a minimum training requirement for the supervisors of those participants. It removes the admittance to a hospital for mental illness and court ruling of a mental incompetence from the list of information that the program must report as evidence of substantial noncompliance with the diversion agreement that it was entered into. And I need to dial in an individual that wants to testify. So if you want to.
Okay, I'll call up Karen Wheeler and Bruce Bishop. Who's ready to go?
Welcome to AT&T's teleconference service.
She is.
Please enter your access code.
Karen, are you going first? Or is Bruce?
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the administrator at the Oregon Health Authority for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. And my scope of responsibility includes the Health Professionals Program, or what we refer to as the Health Professional Services Program. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 101. By action of the 2009 Legislative Assembly through House Bill 2345, the program was enacted, and the Oregon Health Authority was given the responsibility to either conduct the program ourselves or contract out for the program, and we contracted with Reliant Behavioral Health to implement the program. It is a consolidated statewide monitoring program for health professionals who are unable to practice safely because of their substance use disorder or mental health disorder, or they have both of those disorders. Currently, we have four boards that participate in the program: the nursing board, the medical board, the board of dentistry, and the pharmacy board. This bill eliminates language requiring the program to assess minimum training requirements established by an employer. However, it retains the program's focus on assessing the employer's ability to adequately supervise enrolled licensees. The bill also eliminates the requirement for the program to report a licensee to their board as substantially noncompliant when the licensee has been admitted to a hospital for mental illness or has been adjudged to be mentally incompetent. The statute as written penalizes these licensees with mental illnesses who fall into these categories, potentially deterring a person from seeking medical treatment for a serious condition. We've had three licensees since the beginning of the new program. In July 2010, this new program began. We've had three licensees reported noncompliant to the boards for those reasons. So thank you for the ability to testify on this bill in support of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's have Bruce's
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, Senior Counsel for Northwest Permanente. Northwest Permanente is the employer for approximately 1,100 physicians and other clinicians. We're here to support Senate Bill 101. It makes important but relatively modest changes in the program. The requirement on employers of health professionals to establish training requirements has been unclear, and we think the bill appropriately proposes to remove that element from the law. As Ms. Wheeler testified, it also addresses the extent to which hospitalization for mental health should be a condition of substantial noncompliance in the situation of a diversion. The question I think that issue that raises for you is a overnight hospitalization the same as a several day or multi-week hospitalization in terms of the licensee's condition, and should that be reported? But right now, the requirement would be that any hospitalization be reported, and this would take that away altogether. We support Senate Bill 101. We testified earlier today before the House Committee, which is also considering similar legislation. House Bill 2124, I think, is a mirror image of this bill. The House Committee also has two other bills that it's considering, one of which it moved today and the other which it's continuing to deliberate. Fundamentally, we think the policy goal of this area of law should be to encourage practitioners who have a substance abuse or mental health problem to get treatment. We are concerned that instead the law may be creating obstacles to licensees self-referring to treatment, and confusion about what the both responsibilities of the licensee is and what the consequences of their seeking treatment will be. And particularly with regard to the requirements in law that a licensee who's enrolled in the program will have that information disclosed to his or her employer and to his or her licensing board, we think raises concerns with some licensees and will deter them from seeking treatment when they should. I don't have specific legislative language for you today to address that concern, but I'm pretty sure that you share the goal that licensees should be encouraged to get treatment and not try to avoid treatment. And so I would be glad to work with the committee on making sure that that policy is accomplished.
Great.
Thank you.
Comments? Don't leave yet.
I need to dial again.
Okay, we got to dial again.
Whoa, whoa.
I'm confused about something. I know I came in late.
I think it's great. I like the omission of, you know, was admitted to the hospital for mental illness and objected to be mentally incompetent, because those who have experienced mental health issues are extremely, I think, been treated unfairly. There's such a lack of understanding regarding mental illness, and they can be very productive and excellent providers. So I was glad to see that. I do have a question regarding requiring the training requirements. And Sarah, do you want to make a comment at all? From your perspective, and it would be nice to get some. I had some language given to me, and I was just wondering if maybe the groups could work together, maybe with a possible amendment to address.
Sure. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Sarah Basler on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. ONA does have some concerns about eliminating the reference to the supervisor training. We think supervisor training is a valuable tool in making sure that supervisors for this program are adequately prepared to provide monitoring for nurses who are enrolled in the program. As somebody previously mentioned, there was a very similar hearing in the House Healthcare Committee today. We are working on some amendment language, and we'll be continuing to work with committee members and the other stakeholders on that.
So you're aware of what's happening there?
Yeah, you don't have draft language yet. But
okay, you don't. Well, I would like the same for this bill also, seeing if there are issues. Maybe you can't come to resolution, but that's okay. I'd at least like you to talk about it.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'd just like to point out that supervision in the context of nursing may be different than supervision in the context of physicians. And so whether a single directive about supervisory training is warranted across all professions, I think, right, is a question that you need to address. Within Northwest Permanente, our physicians have supervision. I mean, we have a whole hierarchy of supervision for physicians. But we also have a voluntary self-referral program for physicians who are seeking treatment. And it doesn't have to go through their supervisory chain of command. And to the extent that the burden is put on supervisors rather than just encouraging licensees to seek voluntary assistance, that may be an obstacle as well. So We would prefer to allow some flexibility in that regard so that licensees, physicians, or other clinicians can, in fact, seek voluntary assistance through other programs that are already available to them.
Yes, Senator Steiner-Hager.
Thank you. Mr. Bishop, I apologize for not having been in the room for most of your testimony. I'm a little confused when reading your written testimony about the paragraph that on the first page that starts with second, where you're talking about the hospitalization for mental illness. The last sentence says, the bill proposes that any hospital admission for mental illness, even just an overnight one, constitutes substantial noncompliance. But it looks to me that the bill actually proposes taking that out.
Senator Hayward, Steiner-Hayward, you're correct. And
okay.
That needs to be corrected in the testimony.
That's
the
fine. Current, I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't misunderstanding
the
something.
The current law says that any hospitalization is substantial noncompliance. This would take it away. The issue I was trying to raise is it, you know, one or the other, or is there some other criterion that's appropriate to look at? Because an extended hospitalization may, in fact, signify something. An overnight hospitalization may not.
Well, and if I may, Madam Chair, I guess I would argue that if you have a physician who has impairment and is trying to seek help, and that's what we're trying to encourage, that if a hospitalization is necessary to treat whatever the underlying condition is appropriately, then that physician should be commended, or that healthcare professional should be commended for getting the appropriate kind of care. And I'm a little puzzled as to why that would be seen as noncompliance at all if they were doing that in the context of trying to get appropriate treatment for whatever their underlying condition was. I guess it's kind of like saying, you know, if you get diagnosed with diabetes when you're a kid, you need to be hospitalized for a week. Well, that's not noncompliance with your treatment. That's complying with your treatment. Unless I'm misunderstanding something here.
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Steiner-Hayward, that's correct, and that's absolutely why the amendment or this bill is proposed, is to remove that language.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Thank you.
And
if I may,
I think the subtle nuance here in terms of the training aspect is that it's really a difficult, or it's an unenforceable requirement for the program to require the employer to have minimum standards of training. And so I think we can work with the boards, especially the nursing board, has we've had a conversation today about the possibility of having an administrative rule, perhaps, or setting up standards that would apply generally, and the program could have a web-based training. I mean, we'd be willing to do something like that. But for the program to monitor and supervise, and the program doesn't have the authority to do that for employers. I think that's the nuance.
And if I could just add, I mean, in nursing, it is other nurses who are supervising, nurses who are enrolled in the program. And so I completely understand the desire to remove the reference to the employer training, but we think there might be a way to put that back on the supervisor who has a connection to the board.
Great.
Among
Okay. Yes, and we have someone on the phone. Thank you, panel. This is Senator Lori Montes Anderson. Please introduce yourself, and hopefully you're wanting to testify on Senate Bill 101.
Katie.
Okay.
Oh, she has patience. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. So sorry. She can send her a testimony. Let her know if she can send testimony in. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 101 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 387. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 387 comes to you from Senator Bates. And the bill requires a permit to operate a massage facility. It requires the State Board of Massage Therapists to oversee the permitting of the facilities, and it imposes certain prohibitions on and requirements for those massage facilities. It amends specific existing provisions relating to massage therapy, becomes operative January 1, 2014. Otherwise, the bill has an emergency clause effective on passage.
With this, I would like to call forward Leah, is it Bowder? Suzanne Graben and David Fredrickson. And while they're coming up, I have testimony. Well, wait, that's from the same person. Let's see. I am in support of Senate Bill 110, which deals with human trafficking, and goes on to say that this would help deal with some of the massage facilities in which illicit activity is happening, basically.
No, Senator, it was initially 110 and now is renamed 387. It's the same bill.
Right.
387.
Correct.
Yes. Okay. Sorry, I should have said 387, but...
Good afternoon. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the Senate Health Care and Human Services Committee. For the record, I am David Fredrickson. I'm the current chair of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. I reside and practice in Ashland, Oregon. I've been a licensed massage therapist in Oregon for 26 years, initially licensing in 1987, and I'm here today to express support for Senate Bill 387. My massage practice focuses on clinical therapeutic massage for chronic pain conditions. I've been an educator in the field for 13 years. I co-owned the Ashland Institute of Massage, a premier small massage school from 2003 to 2012. I was appointed to the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists by Governor Ted Kulongoski in February of 2010. I'm in my second year of service as board chair. I'm a member of the Policy Committee of the Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards, a national organization representing 42 state massage therapy boards. Senators, nationwide human trafficking is the number one shared issue in the massage regulatory industry. Many states are reviewing their statutory options for regulating the businesses and sectors known to attract traffickers. Massage is a key area of concern. Human trafficking in massage facilities affects every major municipality along Interstate 5 corridor from San Diego to Seattle. The practice of trafficking humans, defined by the United Nations as a form of modern slavery, brings together the issues of public health and safety, domestic and workplace intimidation, violence and coercion, human rights, teen and child abuse, prostitution, immigration, fraud, and national security violations. Massage facilities owners who traffic and prostitute their employees play a dangerous game with the health and safety of the citizens of Oregon. Under current Oregon law, owners of massage facilities are not required to hire state-licensed massage therapists. A key feature of Senate Bill 387, sponsored by Alan Bates, MD of Medford, would require that Oregon state-licensed massage therapists be employed or provided working opportunities in massage facilities that meet permit requirements. Currently, unlicensed massage practitioners, namely the indentured workers within facilities suspected of trafficking, may be fined or censured individually. Before penalties can be enforced, facilities owners routinely move violators between municipalities and states, thereby staying beyond the reach of law enforcement, knowing that enforcement priorities and lack of resources favor them. This has been true in confirmed and charged cases of sexual assault within facilities as well. Facilities owners are blatantly flaunting loopholes in state regulation to continue their business of endangering public health and safety, and their business is profitable. The value of licensed therapeutic massage is recognized throughout the United States by being the number one out-of-pocket complementary and alternative health care expense. Increasingly, insurers, both public and private, view licensed massage therapy as a viable option physicians can refer to in preventative, restorative, and palliative circumstances for safe and effective outcomes, meeting essential health benefits standards. The passage of Senate Bill 387 in Oregon is essential in the maturation of therapeutic massage as a professional partner in state health care policy and as a valued state-licensed health service sector. I'd like to refer to you to the study that you have in hand. The study supports evidence-based massage therapy as part of the Affordable Care Act's definitions of essential health care benefits, and the state licensed providers qualified for consideration to receive benefits. This was compiled by the State of Washington American Massage Therapy Association at the request of the State of Washington Legislature. It employs some of the leading researchers in the United States and has over 900 professional citations and studies attached to it. Statewide, ethical massage facilities, I believe that ethical massage facilities owners are ready to distinguish their profession by delineating themselves from illicit facilities through the permitting process. If massage therapists, licensed massage therapists, are going to be considered as eligible for public insurance reimbursement, private reinsurance reimbursement, it is necessary to delineate illicit from state licensed facilities. Ethical massage facilities owners are joined by the coalition who've provided emails of support to your committee, including domestic violence and victim support services providers, community human service providers, social workers, the ABMP, the American Body Work of Massage Professionals, the trade organization representing the largest number of active LMTs in the state of Oregon, the Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards, the National Certification Examination Board, and the CHP group representing Oregon chiropractic professions. Senators, I ask you to help the massage profession to protect the health and safety of Oregonians by supporting SB 387 and move it forward. Respectfully.
Thank you. And before I ask for questions, let's get the panel to testify, and then we'll ask questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leah Bowder. I am a licensed massage therapist, and I also am currently serving as the president of the American Massage Therapy Association Oregon chapter. The AMTA is the largest nonprofit professional association serving massage therapists, students, and schools. In Oregon, AMTA currently has 1,070 members. I'm here today to support OBMT in their move for a facility license with one amendment. When the original bill that was put forward by the board was Senate Bill 110, and then it moved to Senator Bates' bill of 387. And in that move, there was one piece that was left out, and that was an exemption for individual providers. We don't feel that if you are a sole LMT working by yourself in an office that you should have to have a facilities license. So as long as we can get that exemption put back into the bill, we would be happy.
And I must say, I got a number of positives. But I got one email that said that very thing. She's an individual. She's established a practice in the city of Portland, and she's rented studio space in an art therapy studio and in a room above a bookstore. And they were ideal for her, but if she was having to obtain a massage facility permit in order to rent studio space, the respective businesses probably wouldn't have... she would not have been able to get that space. However, she says she thinks that the bill will inadvertently limit the studio space available to legitimate independent practitioners. But she also made one other point. I don't think it is the massage board's job to get involved in cracking down on human trafficking. That's from Danielle Kitt from Portland.
Madam Chair, yes. If I may. Section on page 2 of the bill, section 2, sub 2, it says the board may exempt by rule a type of massage facility from the prohibition in subsection 1B of the section if the board finds that requiring a permit for that type of facility is not necessary to regulate the practice of massage therapy or to protect the health and safety of the public. I apologize. I've had a total mind freeze, but the gentleman who just testified.
Yes, ma'am.
I just forgot your name, and
David
I apologize.
David Fredrickson.
Thank you, Mr. Fredrickson. I apologize. Mr. Fredrickson, would it be your belief that this provision in the bill would allow the board to make the decision that the types of facilities that were just described about the independent practitioner, either in the letter that I think Senator Mona Sanderson and I got the same letter, or the one that you just mentioned, would be the kind of facility that you would consider exempting by rule?
Certainly. It's my impression that sole providers of massage therapy so employed are exempt from the rules of the legislation as it's stated. We've also gotten permission from Senator Bates to modify massage facility definition to include the licensed career schools and massage services as defined by rule, and also clarify independent workers from a place of home or other business where no other massage therapists work. This is geared toward those facilities that hire multiple massage therapists as employees or provide the opportunity for contractors to work within their facilities.
Do you believe that what you've just heard addresses your concern, or do you think that there are still pieces that are missing that your concerns weren't addressed by what the language in the bill and what Mr. Fredrickson just said?
If that language is added to the bill, yes, I think that would address our concerns.
That language is already in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I believe, unless I'm misunderstanding something.
No.
Which part isn't? Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm confused. If I could, it potentially would allow the board to make exemptions, but I would also think, I mean, we're dealing with people also that individual practice that don't have a facility, they got a portable table and they go various places. I think what we're after here is language that's more explicit to make sure that is specifically directed in the legislation. Correct.
It is clearly the intent of the legislation to respond to complaints against individuals involved in illicit massage activities,
right,
trafficking and prostitution, namely.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Very seldom in human trafficking an individual operator isn't. it's a different thing. So I think we're after just some more explicit language to make sure that the individual practitioners can continue doing what they're doing.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah.
Understood.
Thank you.
Senator Moniz Anderson and other Oregon Senate Health Care Committee members. My name is Susanna Graven, and I've held a license to practice massage therapy in the state of Oregon since June of 2003. I've owned and operated my own medical massage practice in Medford since receiving my license to practice massage therapy. Over the course of the last 10 years, I've been an educator for 7 of those years for the Ashland Institute of Massage, instructing their business development program, which also included massage ethics, as well as the Oregon massage law. I've also been the owner and operator of the Healing Chair for 6 years, a corporate massage business which contracted other licensed massage therapists to work in the corporate environment practicing chair massage. I'm also an active business mentor in Southern Oregon for other massage therapists who are interested in owning and operating their own massage therapy businesses. However, above all other things, above all my other professional pursuits, my first love is practicing massage therapy. One of the challenges of being a massage therapist is having an educated clientele. There are so many different modalities in regards to massage therapy that it can, at times, confuse the general public as to what form of therapy they'll receive when utilizing a new therapist. This is why I highly recommend people are referred to a licensed massage therapist for their appropriate need. Sadly, there are people in my local community who completely misuse and misrepresent the massage industry for means which is completely unrelated to what an actual massage therapist is licensed to do. In Southern Oregon, this has become a situation with specific businesses operating as legitimate massage businesses, when instead these businesses are clearly putting our public at risk for having contractors practice sexual activities in these specific businesses. I am compelled not only as a professional for my industry, but also as a citizen to do my part to create means which will stop operations like these from equating themselves to massage therapy. I am offering my support to the Oregon Senate Bill 387 to amend the verbiage so that the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists cannot just only oversee massage therapists in the state of Oregon, but also the facility owners and operators which employ licensed massage therapists.
I believe that the proposed fee is a nominal price to pay that gives our industry a gain in the pursuit of stopping the sex trade, as well as potentially human trafficking in our state. Senate Bill 387 is just not protecting the public, practitioners, but ultimately human beings from other nations that may be actively exploited and potentially in harm's way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Comments or questions? Not at this point. Okay, let me call then Amy Stark from the Oregon School of Massage and Rose Jade from Lincoln County.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Amy J. Stark. I am an Oregon licensed massage therapist, number 15818, and have been so since November of 2008. I'm representing myself as a licensed massage therapist and the Oregon School of Massage in Portland and Salem, for which I am the student services coordinator. We oppose the facility permit portion of this bill, which we feel imposes unnecessary bureaucratic hurdles and costs hundreds of dollars, or can cost $100 for licensed massage therapists. As such, it becomes an unneeded hindrance to doing legitimate business of providing a valuable health care service. And current regulations are already in place. For example, Oregon LMT requirements and Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2000, which address those issues of concern. I'd like to cite an article from Massage and Bodywork magazine. The article is titled, Massage is Legal, Human Trafficking is Not, where they state that the state regulation of massage therapists can serve as a tool for law enforcement. State-licensed massage therapists have been vetted by the state. Their education has been verified. They have passed an entry-level exam, and in most cases, they've passed a background check. They are professionals. In a perfect world, local law enforcement would stop by local businesses advertising or offering massage therapy and check that therapists are all licensed. If they come across an illicit business offering massage and the practitioner is not licensed, the person is breaking the law. The business should be shut down at the local level, and the person claiming to be offering massage should be reported to the state board and prosecuted. The basic enforcement of existing laws does not happen enough, and we do acknowledge that. Instead of funding an enforcement effort, many states are now considering regulating massage businesses, like this bill, as well as the individual. It creates another regulation for law-abiding massage therapists to follow and pay for while criminals continue to operate unscathed. Laws are only as good as their enforcement, and while many might think that state massage regulatory boards can solve the problem, Robinson, the author, reminds us that these boards can only discipline the licensee or fine those practicing without a license. They can also only discipline those carrying a permit. They have no other legal authority. Boards need law enforcement to deal with the criminals. Additionally, the enactment of this bill would cause an undue burden for a large population of licensed massage therapists who rent space and facilities outside their homes, a population that already struggles financially and has paid over $600 in fees to establish their professional licenses in this state, not to mention the biannual renewal fees of $150. Many of our graduates cite the current expense of licensing as a primary hurdle preventing them from entering the field. The additional obstacle may prevent the addition of highly trained professionals to the workforce. Please take the opportunity to review our written statement and accompanying Massage and Bodywork magazine article illustrating how existing regulations have already led to 1,107 convictions since the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was enacted. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I will do my best to answer any of the questions you may have.
So you're saying that to get your license, you need to pay $600 to the board?
Between the written board exams, the Oregon board licensing exam, the Oregon license, fingerprinting, background check fees, you name it. It is similar exorbitant for someone who works in a field that doesn't pay very well to begin with.
And then $150 every 2 years?
Every 2 years, okay. Not to mention 25 hours of continuing education every 2 years.
Well, this is just one reason to promote Senator Johnson's bill of consolidating all boards so that it would actually decrease the licensing fees by having the administrative work done.
I have no comments on that at this time.
You do not have unanimous agreement on your committee about that one.
It is, yeah.
Because that's more than what a nurse pays finally.
Yeah, it's quite expensive, and not all that money goes directly to the board. I acknowledge that it does go to a certification exam that's administered by an outside organization, but there are many graduates who I see that don't get licensed because they're waiting to save up money for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other comments?
Oh, thank you.
What's on? Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rose Jade. I'm a licensed massage therapist, and I've submitted a rather lengthy, detailed objection to the bill that I'm not going to read into the record, but I will try and cover a few things. I'm also a social worker, and I work for home health and hospice in a rural community where we use massage for our patients on hospice primarily. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But I think the thing that worries me, I'm going to divide my comments into two areas. One is the massage board, when it was originally formed back in the 50s, had facility licensing responsibilities. And they came to the legislature after approximately 30 years of experience trying to fulfill that role and said, please stop making us do that. And I've included a copy of their letter to the 1989 legislature in my packet. And they pretty much set out three reasons why they couldn't do it and didn't want to have the responsibility. As I said to the committee that I testified before last year when a similar bill came before you, the board has failed to give its licensees any information about how it could overcome the major challenges that the board in 89 came up with. I haven't heard anything about how that's going to happen. In that letter to the legislature in 89, the board said that the Portland Police Department, their position, law enforcement's position, was that the business license is not useful for dealing with illegal businesses. It does not protect the public. And I understand that various organizations have called in their support primarily because this is being billed as an anti-prostitution, anti-human trafficking bill. I oppose prostitution and human trafficking. I don't know anybody that doesn't. But I didn't hear any endorsement from law enforcement for this bill. And without law enforcement support, the board is not going to get far at all. Because you go through and do all these things to shut the facility down, you're still going to have to go to a civil court, get an injunction, and seize the premise or something. And you're going to need law enforcement support. So until you hear clearly from law enforcement across the state that they think this is a good idea and they're going to help out, I think it poses more danger by increasing the public's expectation that all these facilities are licensed and it's safer out there. I think it would be better for the board to start a public campaign, education campaign, to urge consumers to ask for a license and inspect the premises before they get on that table. You know, I think that would do more to promote public safety than actually the passage of this bill. The second issue that 89 board said was that the board does not have the funds to investigate for noncompliance of facility permits. And again, I've asked the board, and I included my letter in my packet, what the board has now in terms of budget and staffing that would support doing facility licensing in light of the huge increase of Oregon's population and massage practicing since 89. I have not heard anything back about that. And the other issue was about the exemptions, especially for the solo practitioners who get double billed. And I'm glad to hear that the board is willing to do some exemptions about that, and I think that's great. Personally, I don't think that this bill is going to stop prostitution or human trafficking or actually even increase the sanitation of massage facilities. And that's because law-abiding salon owners and hotels and medical facilities already only hire licensed massage therapists. if you are providing massage in the state of Oregon, you better be a licensed massage therapist. That is the law. So law-abiding businesses are already going to be doing these things. That's that part of it. Now, if everyone decides to go forward and do this, because of the two things, the emergency clause where this would go into effect upon passage, I would strongly urge that any exemptions be in statute, because my patients on hospice don't have time to wait for rulemaking. They need their massage today. They need it tomorrow. They don't have time for the rulemaking process. So if we're going to exempt people getting massage in outcall locations, which primarily means their private homes or their hotel rooms or their campgrounds, that needs to be in statute, ready to go. The same thing for solo practitioners. I sometimes work out of my house. I have a license, a city license to do that, and I also work out of a doctor's office. I am sure that if the chiropractor's office and the doctor's office knew that this bill was in front of you, they would be here saying, we want to be exempted by statute, because we're already, if you have a problem with our facility, I'm sure there's someone else you can already complain to it about. But I think there needs to be a statutory exemption for outcall facilities, including people's private homes. People have a right to receive massage in their private home. The other thing is that, and people on the other side of this promoting this bill might be shocked to hear me say this, but if you're going to do this, you have to also capture the operators of outcall services that don't actually have a facility where the LMT is practicing out of, but someone who's just running a phone business, because that's where a lot of stuff happens also. So in my package, I have actually recommended how you might do that. And that's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we will, I'm not sure what we're going to be doing with this bill, but I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 387 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 111. And Andrea, let's see. John Grossart and David Fredrickson come forward first. Sandy, do you want to bring us up to
date? Madam Chair, members of the committee, this comes before the committee from this at the request of the State Board of Massage Therapists, and is requiring the regulation of body work in the same manner that current laws regulate massage, and it also defines body work.
And we really only have 5 minutes, but hopefully the committee will stay at least to get the testimony, hear the testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Mr. Cruz, and Senate members, again, I'm David Fredrickson. I'm the current board chair of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. I'm here to express support for Senate Bill 111. Essentially, Senate Bill 111 is a culmination of an advisory group that was convened for 2 years between 2010 and 2012. This advisory group was compiled of licensees from various massage and bodywork professionals currently licensed by the Board of Massage. The advisory group meetings were public meetings and followed the guidelines of public meeting law. There are two components of the bill. The first would change the name of the board to the State Board of Massage and Bodywork. The advisory group as a whole felt it was important to include bodywork in the name of the board, as there are several bodywork professional practices that felt that massage does not adequately describe the techniques that they are trained to practice. The bill also defines body work as we're adding the word to the name of the board. The definition for body work is being used is a culmination of the advisory group's meetings. Body work, for your information, is currently defined in Oregon rule. The definition in Oregon rule is very similar in verbiage to how massage is defined in Oregon statute. The changes in the definition of body work proposed would bring it into a line with current board statute, and it's the exemption language that was created and during the last session, and that's under the Oregon Revised Statutes 687031, and that's subsection J. And so the intent is to bring the language defining bodywork into alignment with current statutory exemption language covering bodywork practitioners. The second component would allow the board to list the technique that a licensee practices on their license. It seemed important to bodywork professionals that they have some distinguishing moniker on their license so that persons coming to their practice would be able to understand that they are not, in their words, simply massage therapists, but they have a subspecialty and perhaps a higher level of distinction and training than entry-level massage therapists do. The Assistant Attorney General assigned to the board indicated that the board would need to have a statute change to allow the board to add endorsements to a license. The board was not able to create rules to allow the technique to be listed on the license without enabling statute and to add the license endorsements. So with that, I encourage your support and passage of Senate Bill 111 on behalf of the bodywork practitioners interested in this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson in committee. Thanks for your time and staying to hear the testimony. My name is John Grossart. I'm a certified Rolfer in Oregon and therefore licensed as a LMT. I train at the Rolf Institute in Boulder, and so I've never been trained in massage therapy. I've never done massage therapy. The only time I've ever done massage therapy was for my board exam, which had to be in Swedish when I took it. So I actually had classmates teach me how to do Swedish because I needed to know it for that. I was actually also part of that committee that Mr. Fredrickson spoke of, which was the multidisciplinary task force for 2 years of 2010 and the end of 2011, and then I also transitioned into the reform scope of practice committee for 2011 and 2012, so I was a part of this, but of course I'm here testifying as myself. The big crux of this matter really comes down to terminology, and for people not in the field, it can be kind of confusing, and so the way I describe it is little umbrella massage therapy, which would be how it's traditionally thought of a lot by the public, which would be your Swedish techniques, your deep tissue, the spa type work, the stuff that most people, when they think of, I'm going to get a massage, or you tell your friends, that's what they're thinking about. The crux of the matter really comes down to what I call big umbrella massage therapy, which I would generally term more manual therapy, but that would include little umbrella massage therapy, but also fields like structural integration, a lot of the other types of bodywork fields that currently do fall under the purview of the Board of Massage Therapy. And so what happens is a lot of these practitioners do not consider themselves to be massage therapists, and so they always kind of fight against, why do I have to be a licensed massage therapist when that's not my training, that's not my practice, I don't even care about that term. And so a lot of that culminated in the start of this committee with Senator Johnson pushing that directive onto the board, which they worked with and we were working on. And then a group of other practitioners decided they wanted to push ahead separately, which I'm sure you probably remember Senate Bill 454 from 2011, which was the exemption of some of those practices from the board, which passed. And so that's, they saw themselves as not being part of it. And so the ongoing work was to continue to reform the board, and they've been wonderful at working with the other practitioners, including the current executive director, Kate Coffey, in lowering the bar of entry, per se, for those of us that aren't massage therapists in getting our appropriate licensure, and they've done such steps as allowing the practical exam to be in things other than Swedish, which would have been fabulous when I was going through, but alas, I'm already licensed. Removing the hydrotherapy requirement, because we, structural integration specifically, we don't even care about that, and so it's just another class we have to take on top of our higher levels of requirements. And then also this renaming of the board to be a little more generic. And the real trick is the board has been named the Board of Massage Therapy since whenever it was created, I think 50 years ago or whenever it was. And the terminology of the field has evolved a lot and is still evolving. And so the terminology is what gets into the problem, because, you know, it's not massage therapy. And there's also that, as we saw from the previous bill, that connotation with sexual issues that people want to distance themselves, saying, you know, we're not even massage therapists, so we don't have any part of that background to go along with it. And so that's the big thing. The opposition to the bill is generally going to say, one, it's the board is now starting to cover massage therapy, and I think actually the title is incorrect of the bill. I think it was supposed to be something else. But the board already oversees all these fields. And so what this is doing is bringing the language up to incorporate the fact that it does see all these fields and not just the little umbrella massage therapy, as I mentioned, because its function traditionally and long-term is operating more in that smaller field. And another exemption will say that they're trying to, some people are concerned that the exemptions that were granted are going away, and obviously this bill did not affect those exemptions. The bodywork definition being put in, which some people have a problem with, and that's generally an actually ongoing issue with the field because that's a definition that is in flux for the field within itself too, not just in law. But it's not going to change those exemptions. So the definition is a generic term that's going into law to say what it is, and then there's still those exemptions that take those other practices and leave them alone. So they're not going to have any effect. Specifically, the advanced certification portion was put in sort of on behalf of the structural integrators, who we decided to pull off of the exemption bill and continue to work with the board in getting this because we have a significant body of work that is very distinct and separate, and we have higher education requirements. And unlike in a lot of massage schools where your whole program is, you learn, you know, little classes of lots of techniques, we do 500 plus hours in one specific thing, which is structural integration. And so we wanted the ability to, for our licenses to give some level of protection because of the success, historical success of the work. A lot of people take little classes and try to say that they do it too, and they really don't understand the field and can't practice it effectively with the public. And so I'm in support of it because it lets, A, the public know that they're actually getting a bona fide practitioner of these specific bigger bodies of work. And it also helps give us some title protection to keep, you know, kind of the wannabes from hopping on it too, just because they have a term that they've seen and can sell. And the other part of it was also the idea was we could do pathology or site-specific ones so that there was certain techniques such as breast massage or cancer massage and or cavity work that would allow us to create those certifications that we can verify for the public that they've had those trainings so that people can be sure that their practitioner knows what they're doing in some of those more concernable sites. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. Any comments? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. How does bodywork differentiate itself from chiropractic? I mean, you're doing adjustments, so I'm just wondering, is there a lot of similarities there?
I can't speak on behalf of bodywork as a whole. It's a very broad term, and generally the idea is of chiropractors originally, from my understanding, is they started more working with the spine directly and joint manipulations, and bodywork is more of the working with the soft tissues rather than the hard tissue. Mm-hmm.
That would be my understanding as well. Rather than using the term adjustments in regards to specific joint replacement, body workers and clinical massage therapists utilize soft tissue techniques to help healthy range of motion occur many times at joints without the specific adjusting techniques that chiropractors use.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. With that, the last three testifiers are Andrea Wiener, Rose Jade, and Leah Bowder. And while they're coming up, another email that I thought was significant. Again, these were in support of both the bills, massage therapy bills, and basically the crux of it is so long as the spas and practitioners are following the law, they won't be negatively impacted by any of these bills. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Monis Anderson and committee members, my name is Andrea Wiener. I am the interim executive director of the Feldenkrais Guild of North America and its Oregon regulation coordinator. I'm also a guild certified Feldenkrais practitioner with over 800 hours of training in that area. And before my training in somatic education, I completed a 1,000-hour massage therapy training in California and practice under exemption from local regulation there. And I've also served as secretary of a local chapter of the American Massage Therapy Association and have worked in governmental relations for the Feldenkrais Guild for about 15 years. I support the intent of the bill, but I'm concerned about the language in its current form. although the practice of the Feldenkrais method of somatic education would continue to be exempt from the requirements of ORS 687, under the provisions of 687.031J, the proposed definition of body work in SB 111 is problematic because there is no commonly accepted definition of body work out in the field. The definition in the bill is overly broad. It references an undefined term, touch therapy, and it's in conflict with the Feldenkrais method standards of practice, which have been in existence for over 20 years and which state that the Feldenkrais method is not a bodywork technique. I understand that the primary intent of the bill is to allow for appropriate regulation of the practice of structural integration. And since there is no commonly accepted definition of bodywork, I suggest an appropriate solution, a more appropriate solution, would be to change the name of the board to the State Board of Massage and Structural Integration, or Massage Therapy and Structural Integration, and define structural integration in a way that does not include other practices. Thank you for your attention.
Structural integration, is that the term you like?
Structural integration.
Integration. Yeah.
Structural integration does not apply to the Feldenkrais method of somatic education.
Okay.
However, it really is a question of a definition being properly crafted. I think you've seen a lot of folks in your hearing room since 2007, when the reflexology exemption came through. All coming from issues with the definition of massage in this statute. And so I'm concerned of now a definition of body work that in some ways replicates the issues that we've had with the definition of massage. And so I'm coming here really with an intent to participate constructively so that a bill is passed that meets the needs of those that are bringing it forward and also doesn't unintentionally or inappropriately affect other practices.
Okay. Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leah Batter. I am currently serving as president of the AMTA Oregon chapter, and I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 111. We feel that this bill goes way beyond our Practice Act that was enacted in 1955, and trying to have any kind of regulation or endorsement of various forms of body work is not what our Practice Act intends, and that it dilutes it. And we urge you to not support this bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, comments. All right, David, can you take into account what they've said and then maybe come make a visit with me and we'll see where we'll go with it. All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming to testify. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 111, and we are adjourned.